My name is Norman Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and joining me on the line is Dr. Gerald Horn, author of Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. And Dr. Horn, how are you doing today?
Fine, and yourself?
Oh, I cannot complain. Kind of, I've been moving around a lot, and I'm kind of absent-minded at times, but other than that, I'm good. I saw the film Lincoln, and I know you dealt with the whole question of Lincoln in many books, but I wanted to get your take on not necessarily the film, but because I don't think you've seen the film, but how do you see Abraham Lincoln?
Well, you're correct in suggesting that I have not seen the latest Hollywood blockbuster directed by Steven Spielberg and written by the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tony Kushner. Although I have read numerous reviews, and I know that it focuses on the period leading up to the passage in Congress of the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which bars slavery and involuntary servitude. My understanding is that characters of African descent are not in the foreground in this particular film. And you cited my most recent book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, which presents a sharply different interpretation of the abolition of slavery than that presented not only in Lincoln, but what is presented generally in the U.S. mainstream. That is to say, in that book, I argue that what led directly to the abolition of slavery were the international alliances that the population of African descent were able to effectuate to put enormous pressure on the United States government, which then precipitated a U.S. Civil War. And as you may know, I've argued in a number of books that other than the struggles of peoples of African descent themselves, what's been determinative of our progress or lack thereof have been international alliances and or the international correlation of forces at a particular moment in time. Therefore, it's no accident that as Africa is being, quote, decolonized in the 1950s and 1960s, and as people on the continent are gaining more influence and power in terms of running their own lives in a self-determined manner, they are able to put pressure on the United States government with regard to people of African descent on this side of the Atlantic being subjected to atrocious measures of racism and segregation. And likewise, as we on this side of the Atlantic get more rights and influence, we're able to pressure U.S. foreign policy with regard to its support of colonialism on the African continent. And so it's not surprising to me that that particular interpretation is not adopted by Hollywood, but in any case, that is the kind of interpretation that I think is valuable in terms of determining where do we go from here.
You know, one of the things that I saw that I couldn't understand was there was no Frederick Douglass at all in this film, and to me, Abraham Lincoln without Frederick Douglass is like Harold Melvin without the Blue Notes. You know, that was, I thought it was kind of ridiculous not to even mention Frederick Douglass's name, because I think he played a central role in pushing Lincoln, don't you think?
Oh, sure. I mean, obviously, when one writes a screenplay, one has a certain kind of dramatic license because it's not a documentary film. And the question is the fictional narrative that you create somehow in tune with the spirit of the times? And I think it's also important to note that Abraham Lincoln, it's a matter of public record, for the longest during his administration, was seeking to deport en masse the people of African descent to any place that would take us. Brazil was considered, Ecuador was considered, Hispaniola was considered, that is to say the island that contains the Dominican Republic and Haiti. Central America was considered, etc. And I know that those who would like to present this haloed figure find that kind of truth inconvenient, but I think it's more important for people to know what they're up against so that they can plan strategy and tactics accordingly. You may know that the leading black public intellectual, Lerone Bennett, an editor of Ebony Magazine, wrote a book about Abraham Lincoln where he put forward with dramatic detail that story of mass deportation that I've just enunciated. So this is nothing new. So in any case, that's the story with regard to Lincoln.
What is your take on this physical cliff? Are the American people going to fall off this cliff, or is it something, how serious is it?
Well, I think it's fairly serious. You're talking about the budget negotiations that are taking place in Washington with regard to whether or not Social Security and Medicare will be cut, which is what the Republicans are proposing, or whether or not taxes for the wealthy will be raised, which is the proposition being put forward by the Democrats. It's a classic class war, quite frankly. And on one side of the barricades, you have a number of left-leaning groups and labor unions and black people's groups. On the other side of the barricades, you have the investor class, you have the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, etc. Part of the problem in the United States is that when you make a political analysis, such as what I'm being requested to do right now with regard to the fiscal cliff, you look at the balance of forces on each side of the barricades and the correlation of forces on each side of the barricades. And part of the problem in the United States is that those who you expect to be on the side of labor and the left, at least theoretically you expect it, I'm speaking of, say, a good deal of the white middle class and white working class and white poor, if you look at the voting figures in states like Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama, where 90% of the white population basically supports the GOP, and they're basically saying, cut my Social Security, cut my Medicare. I mean, you know, it makes politics very problematic and very difficult in this country, and helps to explain this nagging and persistent conservatism, which we've had to fight against every step of the way. I say all that to say that it's not clear to me, at least, where this idea of the fiscal cliff is going. I should also say that one of the issues that are on the table is cutting back of food stamps, cutting back of extended unemployment compensation. That is to say, if you lose your job and you're entitled to X number of weeks at X amount of dollars from the government, that may be on the table to be slashed. So we'll see what happens. It's too soon to tell, in my opinion, whether or not the Republicans are going to capitulate.
All right, I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of Negro Comrades of the Crown, and I wanted to move on with the whole question of the recognition of the Palestinians, so-called Palestinian state, and the fact that Stevie Wonder was going to do a benefit for the Jewish the military, essentially, and I'd like
Israeli
to get your
military.
Thoughts. What did I say? The Israeli military,
Jewish
right? Military. Yeah, the Israeli. Big difference. Yeah, I was getting ready to get you and me in trouble. Israeli, right? Yes. Let me clarify that. The state of Israel. But what are your views on that? Those two situations.
Well, I think Stevie Wonder made the right call when he decided that his being designated as a messenger of peace by the United Nations was incompatible with raising money for the Israeli so-called defense forces, which are the spearhead of aggression and expansionism in Palestine, a point that was ratified most dramatically within the last 24 to 48 hours when, in response to the November 29th, 2012 vote at the United Nations enhancing the status of the Palestinian Authority to that of non-member state, the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, basically chose to build more settlements around the sensitive area of Jerusalem, which is slated to be a jointly administered capital of an independent Palestinian state and the Israeli state. This settlement building is basically, at least on paper, foreclosing the possibility of the two-state solution coming forth. And it seems as if Mr. Netanyahu has a death wish, in the sense that he's not only seemingly creating facts on the ground for a one-state solution, a joint Palestine and Israeli state, but as well, it seems to me he's playing a very dangerous game, because this enhanced member status of the Palestinian Authority basically means, A, that it's possible that the Palestinians can go to the International Criminal Court in The Hague and ask that the Israeli leadership be indicted as the criminals that they effectively are. And B, it seems to me that it opens the possibility of the Palestinian state basically having the right to request their friends and allies in the international community to give military assistance in expelling this illegal occupation from their territory. Keep in mind that in the latter stages of the liberation movement that led to independence for Southern African nations, that one of the trump cards held by the Africans was the idea that was perpetually floated that if the apartheid authorities of South Africa did not end their illegal occupation of what is now the independent state of Namibia, that the Namibians could call on their friends in this national community, not least the Cuban military and neighboring Angola, to expel forcibly the apartheid forces occupying that country illegally. And I dare say that if that had happened, I'm sure that the idea then would have been floated. Well, why should the Cubans and their allies stop at Namibia? Why don't they just march on to Pretoria? And that kind of leverage made the apartheid authorities more susceptible to sweet reason, because they had reason to believe, understandably, that they could gain more at the bargaining table than they could on the battlefield. And it seems to me that the vote on November 29th at the United Nations basically creates a dynamic whereby the Israeli authorities may come to believe that they will lose more on the battlefield than they would at the negotiating table. So this vote was very significant, even though it's being downplayed in various circles. But those who are downplaying it, including some of our friends on the left, I'm not sure if they are aware of all the repercussions and manifestations of this very important vote on November 29, 2012, at the United Nations.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of another book called Fighting Paradise. And I wanted to move briefly to the Congo now. The whole question of Goma, the rebel forces have pulled out of Goma, if I'm not mistaken. Could you talk about that?
Well, as is well known, the Democratic Republic of the Congo is at the heart of Africa. It occupies a territory that's larger than Western Europe. It's had a very painful history. Most analysts on this side of the Atlantic oftentimes point to the colonialism imposed by the Belgians more than a century ago, when King Leopold basically held the sprawling territory as his personal fiefdom, and where atrocities of various sorts, including the amputation of limbs, was quite common. But even before King Leopold, you had slave ships, particularly slave ships from the United States, that had turned the Congo into a happy hunting ground. You may recall that it was during the administration of one Abraham Lincoln that you had the last execution, in fact, one of the few executions, of U.S. nationals for slave trading. And this particular U.S. national in the 1860s had kidnapped hundreds of Africans and were trying to take them to Cuba to be enslaved when he was captured. And because of political pressure, the U.S. authorities were forced to put him on trial in New York and then execute him. Fast forward to the late 1950s, early 1960s, when Patrice Lumumba, the Congolese patriot, was in the process of coming to power, and, as you know, was cruelly murdered, supposedly with the assistance of U.S. intelligence forces. And taking his place was a former low-level soldier, then known as Joseph Mobutu, who then imposed a brutal dictatorship on Congo that lasted for decades, once again backed by the United States, which in the 1970s, in fact, helped to effectuate a rescue militarily of a Congolese regime under Mobutu that was coming under severe pressure from his own people. After he fell from power, there was more turmoil, and in fact, this turmoil led to what was, in effect, a civil war in the 1990s, where millions were killed before the rise to leadership of the present leader in Kinshasa, President Joseph Kabila. But the problem in Congo, as your preparatory remarks suggested, is that there's this ongoing rebellion in the east of the country. According to the United Nations, this rebellion in Goma is being spearheaded by Rwandan forces and Ugandan forces. Supposedly, Rwanda, in fact, had a role in the capture of Goma just days ago. Because of this, Britain and to a degree the United States have been talking about cutting aid. It's been reported that they have cut aid to Rwanda, but I've yet to see an overall determination of that allegation. You know as well that Goma and eastern Congo generally is quite a prize, not only being a storehouse of mineral wealth, but it turns out that oil has just been discovered in that part of the world as well.
Right.
As we speak, you have many civilians on the march with their effects and personal items carried along with them as they leave helter-skelter from eastern Congo as they fear for the future. Unfortunately, the United Nations peacekeeping troops, of which there are thousands in that part of Africa, have not been very effective at keeping the peace. Their mandate does not extend to fighting the rebels who have taken over Goma. Part of the problem is that the Security Council of the United Nations is split, not least because Russia and China feel that the Security Council mandate in Libya in 2011, which supposedly was to protect civilians and establish a no-fly zone, was basically overthrown by the United States and its allies in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And there is a lack of trust in the Security Council. That is to say that Russia and China feel that if they change the mandate of the Security Council peacekeeping forces, that another Libya would take place, and the United States and its allies would basically put their placemen, so to speak, in power and get a better stranglehold on that enormous wealth and natural resources that I've just made reference to. And there's a further factor, which is that some months ago, China had tried to broker a deal with the Kabila government where in return for certain mineral concessions, that is to say the Chinese, would be building bridges and roads and hospitals and universities and power stations, etc. But this was thwarted by the North Atlantic powers who have this paranoid hysteria about the role of China in Africa, and therefore that particular promising plan was blocked. All in all, I think it's fair to say that what's going on in the Congo is a tragedy of major proportions.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of a fairly new book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, and I wanted to move on to Mexico, where we have had a change of government, and you know, a lot of people, some of our friends who are supposedly nationalistic. I remember I was in Uganda one time, and some people were saying that we shouldn't be concerned about Mexico because there weren't that many black people in Mexico, which I don't think that's really, there are black people in Mexico, but that really shouldn't even matter. Mexico is a very important country, and what do you think that the new leadership is going to bring to the table?
Well, first of all, a bit of historical background. I assume these friends that you made reference to are aware of the fact that under the leadership of the Mexican president, Vicente Guerrero, who was of African descent, Mexico abolished slavery in the 1820s. This led directly to the secession of Texas from Mexico in 1836, establishing an independent state, and that is to say, this independent state of Texas was established on racist grounds in reaction to a black Mexican president abolishing slavery. And then, when Texas came under enormous diplomatic pressure from the Mexican government and its allies in the international community, Texas then acceded to joining the United States of America, where it presently sits, in 1845. So I trust that your friends were aware of these historical details when they made their remarks. In any case, somehow I doubt it. But in any case, as you know, there has been a change of regime in Mexico. The pre-party, the party of the institutionalized revolution, as it's called, which had been in power continuously from about 1920 till about 2000 before being ousted, is now back in power 2012-2013 under Enrique Peña Nieto. You may have seen the footage of the demonstrations that greeted this new Mexican leader. It seems as if a number of our friends and comrades on the left in Mexico City were not happy with his rise to power. As you know, his predecessor, President Calderon, had led a very brutal war, supposedly a war on drugs, that had led to basically a real murderous conflict between so-called drug gangs and the government in Mexico City, with thousands upon thousands of being killed and thousands upon thousands of being disappeared. Now, that's the story of Mexico that we routinely hear on this side of the border. And it's certainly a part of the picture, but it's a one-sided story if you simply stop there. The fact of the matter is that Mexico is really becoming an industrial powerhouse. And this is something that workers in the United States need to pay attention to. I would dare say that in the next decade or two, there will probably be more cars manufactured in Mexico than the United States of America and Canada combined. I think that's a distinct possibility, not least because the Japanese automakers like Nissan and the German automakers like Volkswagen are moving into Mexico, not least because of the wage scale, which is considerably lower than the wage scale in the United States and Canada. And this is something that the workers of the United States are going to have to reckon with sooner rather than later. And one way to reckon with this is to reach out to our friends and comrades in Mexico, because, as you know, Norman, I wrote a book some years ago on the Mexican Revolution and response of people of African descent on this side of the border. And there is a chapter about Jack Johnson, the predecessor of Muhammad Ali, a man of African descent from Galveston, Texas, and how after coming under assault by the U.S. authorities, he fled into exile in Mexico, where he allied with the Mexican revolutionaries and tried to establish a rear base in Mexico in order to retaliate against the U.S. authorities. So it always befuddles me about some of our friends in the United States, how if you look at any revolutionary struggle, people try to reach out and establish friends on the other side of the border. But somehow that basic, that elementary, that rather obvious approach somehow has eluded and escaped and evaded some of our so-called revolutionary friends in the United States of America.
Okay, this is the last thing. Yesterday I went to a bookstore called The Last Bookstore. It's at 453 South Spring Street in Los Angeles, and there was a book launch and a talk by Selma James. Selma James has a new book out called Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning. It's a selection of her writings from 1952 until 2011. And you have a blurb in the book where you are you're quoted in the particular book. But anyway, this bookstore is a right downtown, and it's huge. It has two stories, and on the second story, they have books there that they sell for only a dollar. I'm definitely going to go back down there and check it out. But Ms. James said that she had, she had met with Mumia Abu-Jamal, I guess for the second or maybe third time, and she mentioned another brother by the Maroon Russell, who was. She said she had talked to him in prison. He's trying to get his position straight on the woman's question. But it was a packed audience, multi-racial, and a lot of, it wasn't just gray beards, a lot of things that I go to are, a lot of people, older people are there, and the youth are not there, but there were a few youth there, and it was an inspiring a meeting. And how did you come about doing the blurb?
Well, I was asked by Margaret Prescott, who is a radio personality on the Pacifica radio station in Los Angeles, KPFK, kpfk.org, for those outside of Los Angeles. And since I do a lot of radio with Margaret, I was happy to comply, and that's how I was brought into the scenario.